Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning.
Good morning, Brother Eddie. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Yes, Chairperson, it's 9 o'clock exactly. If we can start with the meeting.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mathonsi, and good morning to you. Good morning to honorable members. Morning to the team of the Auditor General, the IEC commissioners and executives, the CEO of Government Printing Works. We
Recording in progress.
To receive the presentation on the outcomes that was conducted by the Auditor General on the three institutions that the IEC all were overseeing as the Portfolio Committee, Home Affairs, IEC, and the Government Printing Works. And later on, we'll receive the annual report and the financial statement presentation by the IEC. We are going to interact with these two reports. And as you know, that we're supposed also to deal with the electoral amendment bill, which we're going to interface with it tomorrow in the Portfolio Committee. We must say that we've noted the interaction in relation to the process of the electoral reform or the discourse that has to deal with this electoral reform within our society. And I'm sure the Portfolio Committee of Parliament will interface with that point as we interface with the electoral bill. We just received sad news on Sunday on the passing away of the brother to Honorable Brendan Pillay, who was buried yesterday, and extend condolences to the family. We've extended on behalf of the committee the condolences to Honorable Pillay and the family. Mr. Mathonsi, I will quickly run on the apologies and introduction on members who are here from the AG and the IEC and Government Printing Works. And we'll then take also apologies from the stakeholders if there are any. Mr. Mathonsi?
Chairperson, from my side, from the member side, I've got an apology from Ms. Lefase. She won't be in the meeting this whole week. And then I've got another apology from Ms. Mulekwa. She said she would be leaving at 11 o'clock. She's taking a child to a doctor. And that one of Mr. Pillay, as well as of that of the minister, deputy minister, and the DG chairperson. That's all from my side.
Okay. Mr. Mathonsi, can I check with you first the two issues? One, because the report has been presented here by the AG, where is the minister, the DM, and the just so that we're on record?
Oh, okay. Chairperson, we got a letter from the minister that the minister, the DG, and the deputy minister are attending a UNHCR meeting in Geneva, so they'll be coming back on this coming Friday. So that's why we are not meeting with the Department of Home Affairs and Government Printing Works, because the political leaders are not in the country at the moment. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Mr. Mathonsi, I think if you've observed in the last meetings, we've experienced the members struggling with load shedding and this and that with the network, including yourself. I know that the committee are meeting physically. What is the attitude around that so that we're able to work towards that?
With Parliament, they have not yet informed us about meeting physically, because I think most of the venues that Parliament we have been using in the past in the National Assembly, they burned down. And also, I understand that some of the offices that the staff is occupying is going to be given to members of parliament. So we have not been given an indication that at the moment we'll be going back to parliament to meet physically. I think because of the limited number of venues and the number of committees that are there in parliament.
Okay. We've been given indication that committees can meet physically. What do we do? We have to apply for that slot. So committees have started to meet physically. So can you try to look on that point in your administration work?
Okay, I'll check.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Can we then get an indication from the IC if there's any other apology, Deputy Commissioner?
Good morning to you, Chairperson and the Honourable Members. And just before anything else, on behalf of the IEC, I would like through you to convey our condolences to Honourable Member Pillay. I'm accompanied by Commissioners Moepia, Masuku and Mashinini, and the CEO is here together with the executive team. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Deputy Commissioner, can I get indication from Government Printing Works who is in attendance and an apology?
Chairperson, as far as I know, they said they will not be attending since they are not making any briefing.
Okay. Now we can move to the Director General. Leader of Delegation. Is the yes? I can't recognize the voice. You can proceed.
It's me, Chairperson. Sorry, I wanted to just offer table my apology for 11 o'clock, as communicated to you.
Oh yes.
Sorry
yes.
About that. Sorry about that.
Noted, Co-Chair. Apologies noted. Auditor General.
Good morning, honorable members, and good morning to the chairperson. I'm Pumulani Rabonda from the Auditor General. I am accompanied by a few colleagues of mine, Chama Nongwenya, Vungumusa Tavete, Christine Van Zyl, and also Randani Matamba. These are the colleagues that were part of the audit that will be presenting today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Rabonda. You can now proceed with the briefing. I'm not sure how we're going to run the delegation of the briefing. Well, you can proceed.
Okay. No, let me then just share the presentation. I will be responsible for taking the committee through the briefing that we have prepared for the committee. My colleagues will then assist in terms of responding to the questions that the honorable members may have on our message that we'll be sharing. Just to get a confirmation from the committee if the presentation is showing on the screen.
Yes, yeah. You can see it.
Yeah, yes.
Thank you very much.
Just before that, Mr. Rwanda, pardon for interrupting you. Mr. Matons, you are saying Government Printing Works will not attend the meeting because the minister is not in the meeting. That is the reason.
Chairperson, you remember they were scheduled to brief the committee on their annual report for 2020-2021. So because the minister is not here, they have requested that not they brief the committee together when the minister is here next week.
No, that part I understand. I'm saying they can attend the meeting when the AG is briefing the committee.
I did request them yesterday to say, you know, you can attend the meeting just to listen to the AG. So they said, no, they don't want to break protocols. They will not be attending.
Which protocols are they referring to?
For attending the meeting. I don't know what is the arrangement the department between them and the department, but that's what I was told.
Okay, proceed. Sorry, Mr. Rutan. I thought it was important for Government Printing Works to attend, even if they're not going to comment, so that when the issues that are going to raise with them, at least they've benefited from the platform of honorable members that are engaging with the AG in relation to the institution. But let's note that honorable members, Proceed, Mr. Rwanda.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Just to indicate, our presence here today is to engage with the committee on the audit outcome related key messages and insights as it relates to the audits that we have done for the Home Affairs portfolio, and the portfolio that is made up of the department itself, the government component being the government printing works, and also the constitutional institution, the Electoral Commission. It's always important as we're engaging, Chair, that we maybe reiterate why and who were formed and who are we and what we stand for as the Auditor General of South Africa. That as a constitutional institution that has got a constitutional mandate, ours is to strengthen the country's democracy. And we have got tools that we use to do that through enabling oversight, accountability and governance in the public sector with the one product that we have, which is the audit, which is auditing. So today we are on the oversight part. We are here to enable oversight. We are here to share with the committee what we have observed through our audits, and hoping that that which we should share with the committee is going to enable the committee, is going to empower the work of the committee, thereby realizing our vision of being recognized by all stakeholders, including Parliament, as a relevant supreme audit institution that enhances public sector accountability. For that enhancement of public sector accountability and the realization of the democratic principles of our country to happen, there is what we call the accountability ecosystem, which in a way says that everyone who is involved in making public sector work needs to do their job so that the citizens of South Africa can then realize the fruit of the freedom that was so hard fought for. And it starts with the junior officials in each organ of state, going up to the leadership of those organ of state, the executive oversight and the other oversight bodies outside that organ of state, doing their part to ensure that that which needs to be done, it is done. That way we can then say this ecosystem is working, and at the end of the day, who is going to realize the benefit is the citizen of this country. So as I've already indicated, in terms of the portfolio that we're talking to is the Home Affairs portfolio. I'm not going to repeat that particular part. Yeah, we start off, Chairperson, maybe let me just indicate, we shared with the committee two documents. One was the slides, which is what I'm presenting. Another one was the briefing document. So the briefing document is kind of a mirror of the slides, but it kind of provides some explanatory notes so that the members, as they interact with the slides, they have got this explanatory document that explain what is contained in the slides or what its slide is all about. So as we provided that information in advance, we're hoping that members may have at least interacted with the slides, and that document would have assisted them to understand what is sitting on the slides. So this first slide that I'm sitting on right now is kind of just to track where do we come from and where we are in terms of the picture of audit outcomes in the Home Affairs portfolio. So when the current administration, the sixth administration, took over in 2019, they inherited a picture of audit outcome that were coming from the 2018-2019 financial year, which was indicating that one entity within this portfolio was sitting on qualified audit outcome. Qualified means that there were material misstatements on their financial statements. And then two were sitting in the amber, which is the financial statements were not qualified, they were reliable. However, there were either material findings on compliance or on their performance information. And that was the qualified one was the government printing works, and the two that had material compliance or performance information was the Home Affairs and the Electoral Commission. So where we are sitting now, we have a mix of good news and bad news that with the Electoral Commission that has since managed to improve from where they were 4 years, 3 years ago, and they are sitting in what we call in a term clean audit or a reflection of financial statements that are free from material misstatements, performance report that is free from material misstatements, and an administration that did not identify any material non-compliance. So then they're sitting in the green, that's the one that's in the green, and they managed to maintain that from the previous year. And then we've got Home Affairs that is still remaining where they were 3 years ago. So they're still sitting on amber. meaning that their financial statements are free from material misstatements, but they are still struggling with compliance, and we'll show this, the information or the nature of the findings that is informing the compliance and the findings then. And then, unfortunately, the audit of the government printing works is still outstanding. And just to talk to that particular part of the outstanding information for government printing works, we, due to the system crashes that government printing works encountered in 2021 and the subsequent number of other system crashes that they've encountered, they were unable to submit the financial statement for the year ended 31 March 2021 on time. They only submitted that in this year, a year later in 2022, in May. We have audited that. We finished the audit on the 20th of September, just recently. However, the audit for the year ended 31 March 2022 is still outstanding. We are yet to receive the financial statements. And where we are sitting with that is that the key underlying challenges that the government component need to address for them to come to a position where they are able to submit reliable set of financial statements for 2021. So you see, so for 2022, for 2021, our recent audit outcome is that it's a disclaimer. A disclaimer meaning that there is not sufficient and appropriate audit evidence to support the figures that are sitting on those financial statements. It actually means that you cannot rely on those financial statements. And we're saying for them to be able to move from that and move to a more reliable set of financial statements, a number of interviews need to be put in place. And we've engaged the government to work. We've engaged with the minister as well, and there's alignment to this intervention. One is that the systems of a government protocols needs to be stabilized. We're talking about the ICT environment, which was the cause of those crashes that they have experienced in the past year or two. They need to do much more to stabilize those systems that they can be support them to generate reliable financial information. They need to improve the internal controls internally, including internal control, year-end internal control, the reconciliations and all those related things that relate to the preparation of financial statements. And those are the things that they need to do internally. And the third thing that they need to do internally is that as the system crashes have caused them to lose critical data that informs their financial statements. We're talking about their supporting schedules and their trial balances. They need to then embark on a process of how do we create supporting information that is going to be reliable. And we've engaged with them in terms of the specific things that they need to do, and we're still going to engage with that with them. What we have committed at the AGSA was that we're going to work with them in terms of giving, looking at the plans that they have in place to turn the ship around. We have advised that they need to get in touch with the Office of the Country General, so because in addition to the improvement of the systems, there's also an element of accounting, technical accounting, to say in cases where an institution is faced with this unprecedented loss of data, how do they account for that in line with the accounting framework that they've chosen, which is GRAP. And that's where the Office of the Country General comes in. And will then be part of that process to ensure that the guidance and the advice that they get from that process is reliable and is still going to address the underlying causes as we've defined them. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. They had indicated that they will submit financial statements in November, and we're working with them to ensure that by checking their progress, make sure that that really happens. And we hope that the government component will then work with us in this process. Looking into the portfolio performance, this is quite a busy slide, but we'll try to explain it. So now the information is kind of condensed into Home Affairs and IEC because we do not have the latest information for government printing works. 2021, they have been submitted. That's why you'll see only IEC and the Home Affairs in this picture. So IEC submitted to us an annual performance report that is free from material misstatements. So when we audited, there were no material adjustments that needed to be made on that performance information. But Home Affairs, there were material misstatements that needed to be adjusted. Hence, you see that on the picture there, it says it was red on Home Affairs before the audit, and it turned green after the audit when they managed to correct the material misstatements that they have identified during the process. We are also deliberately reminding government of the strategic targets and the intervention that they've set for themselves when they reviewed the medium-term strategic framework in 2019. Government committed a number of targets for both the Home Affairs and the IEC in this particular component portfolio. And we just want to say, it's important that as we are either planning performance for a particular year or reviewing performance for a particular year, we always go back to say, what did we promise the people of South Africa in our MTSF as the target that we must achieve by 2024? And we have listed a number of those as they relate to this particular performance, that there's a commitment that by 2023, the automated biometric advisory system of Home Affairs will be completed and implemented. There's a target that by end of the year that we have refinished now, 2022, the border management agency will be operational. And then by 2024, it will be operational at 18 ports of entries and six land borders. So those are the targets that they've set for themselves. They will be committed that there will be continuous rollout of the BMA in other ports of entries. And also there will be 100% biometric functionality at the port of entries by 2024. So it's, we're highlighting this thing as a reminder to say, remember what you've promised yourself. Can you please make sure that particular that is achieved? On the IEC side, there's also, there are also some targets that they've set for themselves, including the improvement on the local government voter turnout, the days within which the election results must be declared, the number of registered voters, the target is to improve those to 26.9 million number of voters by 2024, and also the face-to-face interactions per annum that needs to happen between IEC and the public. So those are the things that they've set for themselves, which they need to remember as they are reviewing their performance. And linked to that, we then looked at the current year performance report. What does it tell us in relation to this target that they set themselves? And we are highlighting the fact that they are the targets in relation to the Home Affairs modernization projects, and this relates to the ABIS projects and the other IT modernization projects, that they are behind the schedule. They are delayed. And also there are some targets as they relate to the establishment of the border management agency that are delayed. And I will talk to those ones in just now. So with the Home Affairs, there was a target in the annual performance plan that they want to have 23 port of entries with biometric movement control system. So far, they did not achieve any of that. So as I said, when March 2022, not a single port of entry had that biometric movement control system. The reasons that the Home Affairs attributed to this delay to was that there were procurement delays with the global shortage of computer chips that needed to be used in that particular system. So this page, this picture, Honorable Chair, it shows a summary of what the department already have on the annual report. And we're just summarizing that. Sorry about that. There was also a target relating to the development of the asylum seeker and revenue system into the left capture. And that needed to have been achieved by 2022. They haven't achieved that. And there are reasons that they put there in terms of the appointment of the service provider. And then they also had another one around the number of port of entries and land borders, which would have incremental implementation of the border management agency. And the specific targets in that regard, they said they needed to have BMA incrementally implemented at this border post they also indicated that they wanted to have 11 ports of entries, which would then have a frontline immigration, port health, agriculture, border facility, and management functions into the PMA at each of those 11 port of entries. Those targets have not yet been achieved. When we look at the reasons that the department has given, it has to do with the collaboration with other organs of state, that the implementation protocol that needed to have been signed with SAPS and the Department of Defense have not yet been concluded. And then there's also what they call Section 97 Proclamation, which is about the transfer of function into the Border Management Agency, which has not yet happened. So the agency has been formed. There is an agency that has been formed. There is the commissioner that has been appointed. However, the functional of that agency has been started because of these transfer functions and all the protocols that need to be signed as yet. And I understand this is also what the department will share with the committee when they table their own annual report. We have also looked at then at this project, Chair, that talks to the modernization of the ICT controls within the Home Affairs. And we have looked at the e-visa system and the biometric movement control system. As we indicated that these systems are behind schedule, but our IT auditors have looked at what has been done so far and if there are any weaknesses or gaps in that. And we have identified that there are significant internal control deficiencies that are being seen in the new systems that are being implemented. And those are listed in there. I'm not going to go through them in detail right now because they're two technical terms. However, what we want to leave the committee with is that if these weaknesses are not addressed, it means the modernization project may be having similar signal control deficiencies as the legacy systems. So which means that what Home Affairs is intending to address by modernizing the systems into the new system, they may still sit with that problems if these weaknesses are not addressed. So you'll have new systems with the same problems if these are not addressed. So if not addressed, they need to, these are the challenges that the department will face going forward. And the cause of that, as we see it, is related to poor project management and the governance process within the ICT environment. We also think it may link with the fact that over the previous few years, we have been reporting that there is a leadership instability in the ICT environment in the Home Affairs. It's only recently that they have managed to appoint a DDG for ICT. So previously it was an acting capacity. So that would have affected the department's ability to have strategic leadership of these important projects that they've been implementing. So our recommendation with regard to this one is that the action plan should be developed, implemented, and monitored to address the significant control deficiencies as we have noted them. We have also looked at the automated biometric identification system, which we understand is the flagship project as it relates to the modernization. So we cannot talk about modernization of ICT environment in Home Affairs without talking about the EVIS project. So our observation is that this project is 3 years, 4 months behind schedule, as at everyone March 2022. We'll remember that there was a previous service provider, EOH, who then decided to pull out of a number of government projects, including this one. And on doing so, the department decided to shift the project to IDEMIA, a new service provider. So that both EOH and also IDEMIA, they have been delays that were that both of them had experienced, and it's causing the department to invoke penalties on those particular service providers. So 62 million is the penalty that the government is still dealing with in terms of EOH, and also 3 million is what they're dealing with IDEMIA. We do commend the department in terms of taking advantage of these clauses of the contracts where there are delays in the project implementation by the service provider. They invoke penalties because this is the only way they're going to get the service providers to speed up the process. But the message still remains that the project is significantly behind schedule. Initial budget was 410 million rand for this whole project. That has since been revised to 425 million rand. The reason for that will be the time that has been spent, the technology is changing, technology is becoming more expensive, and also the setting of the contract from one to another. It kind of increases the time that one service provider needs to spend, including how much they need to charge for that. The budget for phase one is, the revised budget is 328 million rand. 94% of that has already been finished. It's 294 million rand that has already been spent. So what we're trying, the message that we're giving, they were saying, is they were not raising a finding, but were saying there is a need for the department to monitor closely the remaining budget to avoid having the need to ask for more funds for this project. Because if that's not done, the government may find itself with a project that they need to fund more from the limited budget that's available. There were some key delays that reasons for the delays that we just want to also highlight, which is the fact that the dependencies relating to data migration and the integration. Data migration and also the integration into the existing system was the challenge that the Home Office experienced with regard to those ones. The testing on stage three by IDEMIA is still in progress, and then there were exceptions that were being investigated as they are busy doing the interfacing into the existing system or into the lab capture. So this project, if it's not successfully implemented, it will have nationwide adverse impact. The department will suffer irreparable harm if it's not successfully implemented, because this project is critical to resolving some of the risks faced by the Home Affairs and the South African Securities Cluster as a whole. Hence, we're saying there is a need to appreciate the impact that this has on the Home Affairs Service delivery, the economy and the Secretary of the State. And everybody who's involved needs to jealously guard this project to make sure that all that needs to be done within the project is done within time and effectively so. Just to move out of that, now moving into this concept called material irregularities. This relates to the new powers that were granted to the AGs through the amendment of the Public Audit Act from the 1st of April 2019. So we implemented these additional powers at all the three institutions, Home Affairs, IEC, and the Government 21. We have not yet identified any material irregularity in this portfolio. And then moving into the quality of financial reporting. So this is the area that talks to the internal controls relating to compliance and also financial reporting within these institutions. So we have, as we have indicated, that the IEC, their audit outcome is in the green. So are the internal controls that inform that audit outcome. We have asked them to be green, most of them. The Home Affairs is amber, which indicates that there are concerning areas that they need to look at in order to improve the audit outcome. And that relates to the daily and monthly monitoring controls, the in-year and year-end reporting processes, and also the review and monitoring of compliance. Just to look at the in-year and year-end reporting, this links directly with the nature of the material misstatement that we identified in the financial statements of Home Affairs. So that had those processes been effectively implemented, we would not have had this misstatement that relates to the accruals and payables that were not recognized, and the contingent liabilities that were not correctly recognized as well. So that they have to improve on those areas. We also looked at the financial health, which looks at the viability of service delivery from these institutions. And the two concerns that we're noting is led to government networks and also with Home Affairs. For government networks is to say, because we have got a disclaimer of audit opinion, which means we cannot rely on those figures, we therefore could also not do a reliable assessment of their going concern and the assessment of their financial viability. Hence, we cannot give an opinion to say, is this entity sitting on a healthy financial finances or not? With Home Affairs, they're still sitting with the historical challenges of failure to collect all the revenue that is due. Hence, their impairment provision for collection of accrued deferred revenue is sitting at 87%. So a big portion of their money that is owed to the department is sitting, it's going to be, they anticipate that it's not going to be in, recovered. So they anticipate to only recover 13% of the money that is due to them. That is a lot, and also judging by the fact that the state is currently under pressure in terms of the budget. We have also noted that issues of claims against the state are still a concern for the department, because 76, the current value of the claims against the department, it accounts to 76% of the budget if we exclude compensation of employees as well as transfers and subsidies. So basically what this means is that if these claims become payable within 1 year, there will be very little left for the department to fund their service delivery mandate. And that's what we're highlighting as a viability challenge for the department. And then around compliance with laws and regulation, as we've indicated that we reported that at the Department of Home Affairs, we reported that the financial statements that were submitted for auditing contained material misstatements, which they had to adjust during the audit process or from the audit process. The department has indicated they're still struggling with a collection of money due to the state. And this one specifically, the biggest concern is there are two. One is with regard to the money that was collected by DECO on behalf of Home Affairs in the foreign missions, that they still struggle to collect those funds and bring them into the National Revenue Fund. Yes, we've seen an intervention through the minister's office engaging with his DECO counterparts to try and improve the process of money flowing in. We must commend the department that they have been an increase in terms of how much gets now paid from DECO into the Home Affairs, but they still have a very huge balance that still needs to be cycled. And also, a part of the impairment relates to that particular spending balance. We know that there are still other foreign missions that the DECO also struggles to repatriate the funds from those foreign missions back into South Africa and for them to be able to pay the money into the National Revenue Fund. Another big concern with regard to that is, which is the biggest influence of us reporting this, is the fines or penalties that the department issues to conveyors, offenders of foreign nationals for contravention of the Immigration Act. So the rules is that if you are driving a bus or a taxi or you are an airline that is bringing a foreign national into South Africa, and there are any contraventions of the immigration rules of South Africa, either by the passenger or by the conveyor, the conveyor gets fined. So those fines are issued, but the department does not have measures for effective collections of those fines, especially as it relates to land borders, the buses and the taxis. They do not have measures to collect those. This is a repeat finding that we've been reporting over the years, and we have recommendations that we've also given to the department in terms of what needs to be done in that regard. We have a new finding this year around the department procuring mandatory IT goods and services. We start going through SETA. They have entered into a contract to procure firewalls services for about 119 million rand, and that was not done through SETA. That then causes the regular expenditure and also this material non-compliance. So this is the findings, as I just indicated, the 119 million rand for procurement. That is the value of the contract. And as what was paid under the contract in the current year was 33 million rand. You will see in the financial statements what will go to their disclosure of the regular expenditure of the 33 million, which is what they paid, actual payment. The other remaining balance will then be recognized over the years as they are paying it. We did identify additional findings under procurement, one relating to employees of Home Affairs who are doing business with other organs of state to the value of 434,000 rand. We gave this finding to the department to investigate and see if these employees are contravening the employment conditions in terms of the Public Service Act and its regulation. And also we have got a small amount of 10,000 rand where an official of another organized state got a contract or a procurement contract with the Home Affairs, which also need to be looked at to prevent these things from reoccurring. At IEC, we had one where a bidder submitted a quotation after closing date, and that quotation was accepted from the processes, which is not supposed to happen, and this was identified as irregular expenditure. We also look at the trend around the irregular expenditure, where we've seen that from 2018-19, we're sitting at around 241 million rand worth of irregular expenditure in cash in this portfolio. That increased in 1920 to 419 million rand. Sorry. It then reduced last year to 54 million rand, and it has increased again to 75 million rand. This 75 million rand share does not include the values of irregular expenditure from government printing works, as the audit for the current year is still outstanding. However, we need to indicate that the 54 million rand that you see for 2021 is understated, because we did qualify the values of government printing works that what they disclose as irregular expenditure is not complete. So it could be more than 54 million rand for the previous year. For the current year, 25 million rand does not include government printing works, as we indicated. So it's Home Affairs and also IEC that makes up this. On the right, we do indicate which are the contracts or the type of non-compliance that are informing the 75 million rand. And we have not yet assessed what the impact of this irregular expenditure in terms of whether there were losses incurred or not, because the IEC and the department still need to investigate this irregular expenditure to determine whether the department or the IEC incurred any losses as it relates to this irregular expenditure instances. We also then, from a consequence management point of view, we track the irregular expenditure that is balances that are accumulating over time. And we have noted that a big portion of the 1 billion rand that was there last year has been dealt with. Dealing with, we mean there would have been determinations, assessment, and also investigation of this irregular expenditure to determine if there are losses. They would have then asked for condonations with the authority applies right off where it's irrecoverable or recover the funds that are lost through losses. So there have not been any fees that have been, or unless that have been recovered. 21 million rand was recovered, and 88,000 rand was returned off. The figures for GPW are not included there, so that is why you see the biggest portion. Is the biggest reduction relates to that would exclude the figures from affairs, because sorry, for GPW, because we do not know how much would they have dealt with in compared 2021 to 2022. We note that a number of investigations are still in progress at both IEC and Home Affairs. That is why on our compliance side, we did not report material compliance around the consequence management, because we take note that these institutions are taking note of these findings. They are investigating them for them to determine the other steps. But we note that 600 million rand worth of the refugees are still waiting for them to deal with it effectively. On the last, as we close the chair, we're just summarizing the significant root causes of the picture as we have painted it through this presentation. And we are also indicating the recommendations that we've given to the accounting officers. So we indicate that there is inadequate review and monitoring of compliance with applicable laws and regulations relating to financial reporting and revenue management at Home Affairs. At Home Affairs, there is no documented policies and procedures to guide the collection of fines and penalties issued through the Migration Act and other long-standing receivables. There's inadequate monitoring and implementation of the action plans. And this one links to the fact that some of these findings that were reported at Home Affairs, they are repeat findings, which means that there are action plans that have been implemented, but they are not being monitored effectively. Reviews performed in the financial statements were not as adequate. Hence, we identified material statements on those financial statements that were submitted for auditing. So the recommendation that we left the department with was that there need to be rigorous implementation of effective measures to enforce and collect fines that have been issued. And they also need to consider to assess the appropriateness of existing policies and or legislative prescripts to ensure that the fines that have been issued in terms of the Immigration Act are effective to deter contravention of that act. And this they can do in consultation with the executive authority, who is then the political head of that function. There is a need for them to monitor the design and implementation of the action plans to ensure that they improve the outcomes. On the IEC side, we are saying that they need to continue with the rigorous and diligent implementation of the action plans that they have been doing, which will help them to sustain the outcome of a claim. There's also on Home Affairs, there's a need to institute timely consequence management against the officials who are not playing their part in implementing the action plans which are defined to improve outcomes. And there's also a need to strengthen oversight and interventions to remediate the loss of data at GPW. So this is the part where we speak about. While we are supporting GPW for them to be able to get ready to submit financial statements, which are credible, but all the role players within, they need to make sure that they strengthen their role, including the oversight role, to ensure that the effects of the loss of data are remediated as soon as possible. And then the message that we are leaving with the portfolio committee in this regard is to the portfolio committee to consider that in their follow-up and engagement with the authority and the accounting officers to track progress on action plans that have been put in place, provide oversight on the measures that are relating to the collection of fines, the oversight and intervention at GPW to track those and see what the government is doing to remedy that particular challenge that they have there. And also provide oversight and intervention for Home Affairs modernization projects and the significant deficiencies that were reported in that particular project. And looking at the interventions for collaborations and cooperation by the other institutions, specifically the Department of Defense and also SAPS, as it relates to the implementation and operations of the BMA, which will need to lead to the signing of that protocol that will ensure that the BMA gets implemented effectively as planned. Chair and honorable members of the committee, this is the message that we're prepared to share with the committee. Thank you very much for the time. Let me pause here and through you, Chair, I make ourselves available to answer questions.
Thank you very much for the brief and the work, Mr. Rabunda and your team, for having briefed the portfolio committee on the issues that are arising. That requires our key focus on some of the weaknesses that we've identified. But I think also must appreciate on the work progress that you have identified as a result of your intervention. I'm going to invite honorable members to interact with the report, and I'm sure when we're going to interface with the minister in the next meeting, some of the issues they'll be more clearer. And it's good that the IEC, and I've noticed DDG Mavuso and CFO Holambe in the meeting, that it was important, even if your minister is not here, just to listen, so that when the committee is going to interact with the departments, at least you've benefited from some of the issues that members may have raised with the AG. I'm going to invite the Honorable Molekwa, Honorable Tito, Honorable Kanyile, Honorable Ross, Honorable Mutise. I'm not sure if there's any other member who I've not noted, but they'll raise their hands. Honorable Founder members have a network issues where she's traveling, so she will indicate when she's been in a good position. Honorable Molekwa.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me start by appreciating the report as presented by the AG office, and also appreciate the entities that have done better on its performance report. We hope that they will also develop a plan to perform better in the next coming financial year. Chairperson, I just want to start with my comment on the government printing works on the non-submission. Chairperson, this matter has been a long-standing matter. Can we be clarified on what could be the challenge and what needs to be done in order to be able to comply with the audit process, especially on this submission of the document for the AG office to be able to process the audit process? On the issue of the internal control, Chairperson, I also want to check that if there are any plan in place to intervene so that there are proper internal controls being put in place to be able to control whatever is happening at the financial department, for the department to be able to improve on the performance audit outcome. Chairperson, on the presentation, I think the OIG office has also raised other critical issues that impacted negatively on the audit outcome of the Department of Home Affairs. So I just want to check with the department if there are any other mechanisms that can be put in place in order to change the audit outcome and also to develop a plan to make sure that in the next financial year, the audit outcome is being improved, given the current situation that has been presented by the AG office. On issue of the irregular expenditure of 622 million, that is not dealt with. I just want to be clarified on what exactly the plan. Is there any plan in place in order to be able to recover the money? Or what is happening? And what was the cause of this irregular expenditure of 622 million? And then the outlook of the financial report of the government printing works posed a negative impact to service delivery, Chairperson. So I just want to check if there are any intervention that can be put in place in order to assist the government printing works to recover from the current state. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Molekwa. Honorable Tito.
Thanks, Chair. Greetings to the members and everyone who is present. I would also like to thank the Auditor General for giving us a briefing today on the audit report of government printing works and the IEC and the Department of Home Affairs. Chair, I also like to raise a concern on GPW, on government printing works, because of whenever there is time for them to give us their audit reports, there is always this culture of data and all of those things. And also the AG was saying that on the details of the procurement findings, the AG said that there are documents that were sent late due to the closing date. And then is there any maybe accountability? Is there people who are accountable on whether why are we receiving documents that were not supposed to be given to us? Because of whenever there is a closing date, automatically you must not give us those documents. And then is there anyone who is being held responsible on that matter? And then check on the issue also of government printing works. The government printing works. I think that it was last year when the minister was saying that the auditor general and the minister, they are going to monitor the government printing works in terms of their financial reports, that they are going to give us everything on time and all of those things. But right now, the auditor general is still coming to us and telling us that they are still late with everything, and they give them that audit report of last year, and then they did audit them. But now, why didn't they put someone there to monitor the government, the office of the government printing works? So is it only the minister who's going to be held responsible in terms of when we are not receiving the documents, and then we must blame the minister of Home Affairs on everything? And on the Department of Home Affairs, Chair, compliance with key legislation, what mandatory IT goods were not procured through CETA, and was there a priority approval for this deviation south from the Treasury? And has the AG also observed reason to be suspicious of the loss of audit data in 2 years around the time that audit information is due? And given also the disclaimer audit in 2019 and 2020 observed by the AG, is there reason to believe that GPW could have received a disclaimer audit opinion even if it has not lost any data at all? And has the AG also noted any attempts by the GPW to address the ongoing shortfalls in the IT controls? And does the AG have indication that the culture of consequence management has improved in the Department of Home Affairs from the prior audits? And Chair, on the other hand, the Minister, I was saying that on the issue of GPW, is the Minister the only person that we are going to say that he is the one who must be held responsible? It's a question, Chair, we must ask ourselves, all of us, because of we went there, all of us, for two oversights there at the GPWP, and we went there to implement solutions. We thought that the AGs also, officers, will also go there and assist us in terms of making sure that everything is going to go accordingly. But still, we are sitting here, we are coming back, and it's the same story that we did not receive reports on time and all of those things. So it's a question, Chair, are we only going to hold the minister responsible on the duties that all of us, we must be accountable on? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Tito. Honorable Kanyele. Okay, Honorable Ross.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you to the AG's office for this report. Chairperson, allow me firstly to express on behalf of the Democratic Alliance our sincere condolences to Honorable Pillay on the passing of his brother. I think we were really deeply shocked and saddened, and we wish him and his family well. Chairperson, a few questions for the AG's office. I'm going to start with the minister talks about Home Affairs becoming a security department. And again, we see serious IT security concerns year after year. These are always repeat findings. They don't seem to have been dealt with, and the consequences are becoming dire. So, for example, we see that Government Printing Works had a crash, and then they started a project of reconstructing the records, and then had another crash where they then lost all the data. It's inconceivable that you would have a crash that causes tens of millions of rands worth of reconstruction work, and then you don't do the backup straight away. It's inconceivable. And then we also saw the report on permitting as this committee, where we were told there's no access controls, logs are easily deleted, the systems are unsecure, and this has led to an environment where officials can work with outside forces to issue legitimate documents that are illegal or not secure. And my question to the AG is, have you picked up these specific issues before in previous years? And to your mind, what was done about it, if anything? Because surely you picked these specific things that this permitting report picked up. Lack of backups, no access controls, logs deleted, unsecure systems. Surely you've picked this up, and either something or nothing has been done about it. So I just want to get clarity on that. Then you talk about consequences for officials who do not implement action plans. And, you know, I think we as a committee, we've certainly on things like the ABIS that appears in this report, on a number of other items, we call Home Affairs to account. They say they are doing this and that. They show us an action plan. And then we get this report every year and it's the same. And we clearly need to take bolder action. So my question is as an auditor, what are your specific recommendations of the absolute key things that need to happen? Who should be held responsible? What are the most urgent measures that this committee should consider so that we plug the security gaps in this department, which is really under attack from people that want to issue fraudulent documents? Then we see that GPW, you say that basic controls such as inventory and asset counts are not done, or they're not done timeously. I just want to understand, does this include things like security paper, exam papers, or what exactly do we mean by inventory and asset counts? Because it would be a serious concern if there was no inventory control over security paper and exam papers and things like that. And then what are the reasons given? Because surely there's some reason given why they have not done it. As you say, it's a basic control. Then I also don't understand, and you mention it, that this issue of not collecting from carriers is an ongoing thing that doesn't seem to be resolved. And you mentioned that you made certain recommendations. If you can just share those recommendations with the committee. Because Chairperson, the problem with this is that we've had a number of issues now where the minister extends visas via some sort of proclamation. And then persons arrive at the airport and they are told, no, sorry, you don't have a travel document. We are going to deport you now. But the carrier should have stopped them on the other side. So the fact is that they're not being fined, and therefore it appears that they're not being careful. It's resulting in dire situations. I mean, it's pregnant women stuck at the airport and sitting there and alleging that they don't get food and water, et cetera. It's not that this is an issue that only has a financial consequence. People are now landing here, and they're finding that they're not allowed to come in, and this should have been checked by the airline. So the question is, what were your recommendations in that regard so that we can consider them for our report? My second last issue is that you say claims against the department at year end was 76% of next year's budget, including what you said. So I take it this is contingent liabilities. Can you give us an actual figure for this 76%? How many millions or billions is it? And then the minister established, got a few lawyers in and established a task team to look at this contingent liabilities. Do you see improvements in this regard? And then finally, what were the issues behind the irregular expenditure in the 199 million rand security tender? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Mudisemtse.
Chairperson, she's not in the meeting.
No, thanks for those contributions, members. There are three issues which I wanted to get the AG perhaps to expand more. And I think fully agree with all members who have raised questions and ventured also on the areas that have to do with the government printing works. I think Honorable Tito, you are correct that we conducted an oversight there on many a times. The minister established a task team to look on the governance and financial status of government printing works, including the loss of data. And that presentation was made available to the attention of the committee. I want to establish from the AG whether in your course of audit, did the minister or yourself benefited from that outcome of that report? And what are the measures that you have taken? Because I could thought that some of the issues that are rising, they are within your scope of work that perhaps you may need to consider, if you including the recommendations that you put in place. That's the first point. I think I wanted just to get the attitude of the AG, whether they got into the report of Memu Jungu and the team. Because this is informed by your statement that the financial stability of the institution is unstable. The second point is on the action plans, which obviously in your last briefing, the institution briefed the committee that they're going to establish or to develop action plans that will mitigate what you have identified as weaknesses. And it will be important just to highlight progress thus far from the Home Affairs, IEC, and Government Printing Works, whether those action plans that were developed and agreed to with the minister has taken responsibility, whether there was a progress, and if there was a progress, in which area, and where there are weaknesses, so that we're able to do that. The you are indicating, and I'm happy that the CFO is here, and I think we'll, in the next meeting where Home Affairs are going to present, they'll have an opportunity to, and the DDG have also to take up some of the issues, including the this thing of the IT. It is quite clear that there are two versions of progress report. And in our last two committee meeting, when the Home Affairs was briefing us on their IT, there was a great progress that was presented. And you are presenting a different picture of the difficulties that are confronted by Home Affairs. So I'm trying to ascertain, to reconcile, what does it mean now that, because in practice, for example, which perhaps you may be correct, that at all times you find downtime of IT system at Home Affairs. I could give an example. Before the minister went to Geneva, I was at Home Affairs there by in Bulugwa, and the system were down. And there was a long queue almost the whole day. And I wanted just to get the impression of the Auditor General, and what is their attitudes towards that. The last point, which is the Home Affairs, you will know that you are boldly saying that there's instability in the IT system. Of Home Affairs, they've appointed the new DDG, so forth and so on. And I'm not sure that you'll correct me. The information that is that it appears that they've suspended the same DDG with issues related to the IT. I'll be corrected if that I got it correctly. Now, do we measure the stability of the institution in relation to the current challenges we're facing with the appointment of the staff or DDG or so forth and so on? Because in your preamble, you are indicating that the AG ought to safeguard the resources and make sure that those resources are directed where they must service our people. So I wanted just to impression on that, the AG. There's a glaring highlight you are making in terms of what Honorable Tito raised on procurement services that was done outside the normal standard. And it appeared there are no consequences that goes with those, and what is the attitude around that? You highlighted correctly, and I'm happy that the collection of fees, there's a demonstration that the department are working towards that. And I think that is one area that I think we may need to appreciate in the foreign missions. But the question is whether you have managed or able the AG to get able to get into audit of all the foreign missions that were collecting the fees. You recall that there was a site in our last briefing during COVID. There was an attempt to brief the government that it was COVID, you could not do this and that in terms of the foreign mission. Whether you have gone into the space to audit the team. Thank you. I'll invite you and your team to respond. Then we get to invite the IC. Mr. Ronand, Robin there.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of the Committee for these questions. I will start by just highlighting some few questions that I will request my colleagues to get ready to answer them once I am done. The question from Honorable Tito around government printing works on whether we're seeing an improvement around their IT systems. Wongomusa, please get ready to answer that one. There's a question from Honorable Ross regarding the weaknesses that we picked up at Home Affairs on the IT systems, whether we have picked this up previously. Receiver, please get ready to answer that particular question. And then there is a question again from Honorable Ross relating to government printing works on the weaknesses that we noted on the basic internal controls relating to inventory counts and assets. Wongomusa, please get ready to answer that one, specifically relating to what type of assets are we talking about or inventory. And then Honorable Ross wanted to know the actual figures of the contingent liabilities claim against the state at Home Affairs, and also if we're seeing an improvement as it relates to the previous year. Chairman, please get ready to respond to that one. And then lastly, the last question from the Honorable Chair around our audit, how much we've managed to do in terms of the audit of foreign missions. Rendani, please get ready to answer that one. I think there's a question around the accountability ecosystem. It came from Honorable Tito, and then it was also reiterated by Honorable Ross. And it was talking about holding the minister accountable and who else needs to be held accountable. That's why we have that first picture around accountability ecosystem, Honorable Chair, that all have a role to play within the system. And that also means that oversight structures have the right to also determine who in this accountability ecosystem do we need to call to account. So it does not, the committee does not need to only call the minister or the DG. There are internal audit functions in all these institutions. There are audit committees in these institutions. Those role players, because they are the internal assurance providers in these institutions, they need to also be called in to be asked, what have you done and what have been the findings from your work, and what has been the attitude and responses from these institutions as you are reporting on these witnesses? So I think these functions can assist the committee a lot in terms of either complementing, correcting, or clarifying the message that we're giving. Because as you understand, some of these things are repeat findings, so which means that if they're repeat findings, they must have been in the space of the audit committee and internal audit as part of them addressing the risk and the weaknesses. So if there are parties that need to be called in to engage the committees on these things, is the audit committee and also the internal audit, according to our view. Honorable Mulekwa made a number of comments and questions. I stand to be corrected, Chair, please bear with us. And I think these questions were directed at the institutions, Government Frameworks, Home Affairs, and also the IEC as well, as for them to respond to as they are tabling their own particular presentations. So you'll indicate to me, please, Chair, if there is one particular one that needed to be addressed by the Auditor General. From Honorable Tito, the finding from IEC relating to the late RFQ, I understand also that one needed to be addressed by the IEC in terms of what is happening, what are the consequences for the people who were involved in that one. Okay, and then the question from Honorable Tito around the what is the AGFS suspicion in relation to the data loss. I'm going to answer this question also in covering the question from the Honorable Chair in terms of the outcome of the investigation that was done by the panel that was appointed by the minister. We have received that report, recently received it. I think it was on the last stages of the audit. So we were not able to timelessly engage with the report to the detail of understanding what is contained in the report. And that is the process that was still busy with at the moment. And that investigation report would then enable us to fully have a detailed understanding of who did what and was supposed to do what, and what are the recommendations that the panel is proposing. The reason we are placing reliance on the report, or we are relying on the report to give us the thing, that we do an audit. We see at face value what is happening. We can tell that there are weaknesses in the drug control system, there are weaknesses in the IT system, there's data crashes. But the reasons behind those, we can only try to link them to what we've reported before, to say, GPW, your systems are stable, there are not absorption backups or controls around these systems. That's what we reported before. But in terms of the real motive and what really happened that caused these crashes, the investigation can assist us. That's where we need to go through that report in detail to be able to be informed. And that will also support our audit approach as we move into the next audit of 2022. Okay, and then a question from Honorable Rose around what are some of the recommendations that we are giving the department around this collections of files. Honorable Rose, so on our presentation, which I'm just going to share again so that we can, this presentation. Sorry. So this part of the presentation, we are talking about the first recommendation that we said there need to be rigorous implementation of the effective measures to enforce collection and fines. That's the first part. The second part of the recommendation is talking about, in consultation with the executive authority, management should assess the appropriateness of existing policies and or legislative prescripts to ensure that these fines are effective to deter contravention of the Remediation Act. And the reason this recommendation is in two parts is because, one, department is issuing fines. So we cannot just issue a fine and then leave it like that. When you issue a fine, it's upon you to be rigorous in terms of ensure that you have good processes of tracking these fines, following up these fines, and being able to collect these fines. So you have got a conveyor, a bus company that is owing the department, but that company, bus company continues to be operational into and out of South Africa, whereas there is a big part of them ignoring the rules of the country where they've got a fine and they're not paying that fine. Because if you're not paying a fine, that is short issued in terms of the act, it's ignoring that particular act that issued the fine. So hence they need to take it upon themselves to make sure that there are policies, there are processes that they put in place to track those fines. They know this, who are these buses companies, these bus companies are still entering the country on a daily basis. That's the first thing. The second thing is that there could be some legislative weaknesses or gaps that do not help in terms of the government processes or the process of collecting these fines. Hence, we're saying it then becomes upon the department to look at this, their own policy, and also look at the legislation itself. What could be the weaknesses that is hindering them to be effective in terms of collecting these fines? And that's why we said that must be done in consultation with the Azure Authority, because he is the owner of that particular legislation, or the custodian, sorry, of that particular legislation. Hence, they need to look at those things. Those are the parts. And another part, the reason we talk about the legislation is because the Act has placed the fines as a way of deterring contravention of the legislation. Then there's a reason, these fines now are not being paid and nothing is being done about them. Then it asks the question, what other measures are there to deter contravention of this legislation? And it's for that reason that the department needs to look at this thing. These fines, are they still the most effective measure to deter contravention of the Immigration Act? Or they, we need to relook at these things and they have other measures. We are just letting that as something to look at, and then the department needs to, within themselves, be able to do that. There were a few questions from the Honorable Chair, so I've already dealt with the one on the ministerial panel's report. The question around the action plans, whether we're seeing progress in these action plans. For IEC, we'll say that the action plans that they've put in place to maintain the good outcome that they had in the past, we see that it's working as they were able to maintain that. And then that's why we're advising them that they need to continue with the rigorous and diligent implementation of this action plan. They need to continue with that. They should not lose their guard in this particular regard. For government printing works, the weaknesses are there that they are repeat issues. So the finding that we're, or the weakness that we're reporting on the IT side, is the it's an indication that the action plans are either not effective or not being implemented appropriately. The finding that we reported around the collection of fines, and also the finding that we reported around the misstatement that were in the financial statement that is submitted for auditing, which talks to whether they are implementing effective steps to ensure that there are appropriate and adequate reviews in the preparation of the financial statement to avoid misstatements. So those are where we say for Home Affairs, these things, there is a need for them to hold officials accountable, those who are supposed to be part of either preparing the action plan or implementing it. Because if you have an action plan and the action plan is not fully implemented, somebody didn't do their job and they need to be held accountable. The AGS reflection on the Home Affairs Service delivery. I think as part of the audit, Chair, we did do some observations. So what we do is that we have some regional visits where we visit some regions of Home Affairs or some branches. And we have some few observations as we are doing those audits, which they're not necessarily part of our audit, but we observe to say, if I'm here to audit assets or here to audit supply chain in this branch, can I just also observe how this branch is operating? There are some few observations that we've made, and I will request that Rendani, please cover that as you respond to the question that I've allocated to you. And then the question on the DDG. Maybe just to bring in context again to the why we mentioned the issue of the DDG. So we were talking about the weaknesses that we have identified with this modernization projects. To say the modernization projects are still showing the same signs of weaknesses as we have seen with the legacy projects, legacy system. And if they're not addressed, they are going to cause more challenges for the Home Affairs. And we indicated that this could have also been caused by the fact that historically this position took time to be filled. It was only 18 capacity. And previously, we highlighted this area of the time that is taking for the department to fill that particular position. And they had since had filled it. So we had not yet then assessed since was filled what happened, including the suspicion. I think that's something that we didn't touch on. We're touching it from the point of historically what could have been some of the causes of this weakness in IT, that because there was not a stable leadership at strategic level, then that's why there could have been this weakness in terms of there was no leadership. And now if the cases that there is further suspension, it could also lead to the recurrence of these weaknesses, because we had alerted as a problem the fact that if you don't have a permanent DDG in that particular IT area, it leaves the department vulnerable. And then also the question around the consequences for procurement findings. I think this one is also better addressed directly to the institution themselves, the department. So department on the procurement findings on IT, when we first engaged with them around this finding, they themselves were very adamant that there was nothing wrong at first with what they did. They were of the view that the legislation differentiates between what they call mandatory IT services, which must be procured through CITRA, versus non-mandatory services, which is at the option of the department whether to go through CITRA. We argued with that point. They decided to go for a legal opinion through, I think they went to the state law advisors. The state law advisors came back and said, the department, you were wrong. You should have went to CITRA. This is one of the items that you should have procured through CITRA. And this had to do with the procurement of firewalls for that R119 million. So it therefore then needs to, because now this is regular expenditure, they must investigate and say, what are the real costs of this thing? Did they lose any, make any losses or not? And what should be the remedial action? Remedial action can include displaying people who are involved, and also include improving the processes to ensure that this does not repeat again. However, the reason this is a significant thing for us is because the CITRA was formed for a reason as the IT agency of the state. And if CITRA is got weaknesses themselves in terms of being able to support government on the side of IT systems, or if the departments do not have faith in utilizing CITRA, and then there is a haphazard utilization of viruses provided without a central point that is certifying the quality of the service that the state is using, it opens up government for a lot of challenges. So if there is a challenge that maybe they're working at CITRA, there's a need then for government to put intervention to strengthen CITRA, because you cannot then have a department haphazardly procuring from all over the place without a central point that is going to be certifying the quality of those particular services. We're talking about firewalls. Firewalls control the traffic around the systems of the department. And without the involvement of CITRA, then there is no assurance in terms of are these firewalls really going to protect the department from the threats that will be the IT threats or threats relating to the IT system. So those are the response that we have on this side, Chair. So let me just reiterate a message for my colleagues for them to understand. So Musa, you will start with the government printing works questions. Randani, you will then come with the question that I've already to you, and then relatively you will then ask this in terms of the IT questions. So just to reiterate, Musa, the question around, are we seeing improvements on the IT environment for government printing works? I think you can also cover the background on the number of crashes that we've witnessed in that space. Again, the question from government, from Honorable Ross Bomusa, was around which type of inventory and assets are these. And then, okay, and then Randani, the question on the, I think you share with Chaman, the question on the actual figures for the contingent liabilities and whether we're seeing for improvement on this one. And also the observations that we have seen as we're visiting this, some of these branches of Home Affairs, and also our audit of foreign missions. And recently you'll then come last in terms of the weaknesses that we've seen over the few years, past few years, and on the IT environment for Home Affairs. Let's start with you, Umut. Thank you.
Thank you, Hamani, and greetings to the chairperson and the honorable members. It is safe to say all protocol observed. I will quickly go through and deal with the matters relating to GPW. In this regard, I'll just okay. I think in the main, what I will cover, which will assist a number of repeat questions that were coming in so far as the submission of the financial statement is concerned, is to quickly give you the date analysis of what would have happened into GPW. In 2020, that is when we had given them the 1920 outcomes, which was a disclaimer. It was December 2020, so 1 month later, which was in February 2021, they then experienced that major system crash, which simply means at that point in time, they would have been thinking about resolving the schema issues, in fact, trying to draw an action plan, and then the system crashed occurred. So what it meant is that as at end of March 2021, they would have closed that year and then prepared the financial statement and submit them by the 31st of May 2021, and in which they did not, they could not submit those because when the system crashed, it deleted almost all the data that is there in the system to allow them to prepare the financial statement. They are system driven most of the time. Invoices are created from the system, even though they get to be printed out, but mostly a lot of data is created from the system. So without that system, they may not be able to create a proper data in terms of this. It then took them almost a year, in fact, it is a year, to be able to recreate data. Around 2022, when they thought they had created data, it was in January, and then another system crash occurred, and then there was another one that occurred on the 25th of March when they had started to recapture again. There was another one that occurred on the 11th of April 2022. So what it means is that these system crashes, what they do is that they make them to reverse back whenever they think they have captured the data, they are ready to go to prepare something, and then they reverse back. So that is what is one of the major problems that they have. So on the 31st of May 2022, that is when they were able to give us the financial statement for the year 2020-2021. That was almost a year late. Yes, it was a year later. And at the same time, when they were submitting those financial statements, you'll ask the audit committee members, they were not happy with it because when it was created, they were in a rush trying to submit the financial statement because now they had not been able to retrieve that key data that would have assisted them to compile a proper version of the financial statement. Hence, you will see that in 2021, 2022, when we reported in September, we gave them a disclaimer again to say the data or the information that you try to reconstruct and give it to us could not be supported by proper documents. That is one main drive of this one. But the second one is the question of whether if there was no system crash, could they have managed the situation? It's a bit tricky from the business to charge it. In a sense that it's a question of whether did they prioritize resolving the prior issues or did they prioritize capturing the data so that they can create a version of the financial statement. The results from the 2020-2021 tells us that they did not prioritize rectifying any matters that were raised in the prior year. Most of the matters that we raised in the December year, which is 2019-20, they reoccurred. So meaning when we presented the audit report for 2020-2021, it reflected both years' information that was not corrected. And that is what the data tells us. So the next part that was asked, it was more around whether the financial health of the entity is seemingly needs some assistance. The disclaimer point that we have expressed here, it says we are unable to make an informed position, but we must indicate that largely GPW is not supported by government through grants, but they get revenue on the basis that government will be procuring from them. So they did not request any additional funding in the current year, and they did achieve, I think, the profit in the prior, but those results are not necessarily reliable because we have not audited them. Hence, we are saying from that perspective, it's not easy for us to judge in terms of whether they are struggling financially in terms of dealing with their own affairs. The only area that is a challenge and the bigger challenge is that they are not able to give us a reliable figures that will allow us to assess as to how their performance is. So that is the key area that we need to emphasize. There was also another question around whether did we identify these IT issues in the past. I think Fumlan did cover that. We did identify the IT issues in the past, and we raised with the entity. They were supposed to resolve them. Just when they were thinking of resolving them, then the problem occurred. And then I think it has also been answered, the issue of the usage of the report that came from the task team. And we are indeed studying that report so that we can be able to see the impact of it. The issue around the assets that we are referring to, what is expected from the institution is to do the count of your assets on a yearly basis, meaning you must go and count all your desks and all your systems and so on a regular basis. That is what we are referring to. We're not referring to the security paper. We're referring to the regular assets that they use to present their service delivery, including the inventory. Inventory, it is those items that they use to sell to different departments, meaning the materials that they use to create the paper and so on. So those ones, because they had not done it on time, and then they could not be able to reliably give us the proper figures. For example, the asset count that was expected to be done by the 31st of March 2021 was not done timely, which then makes it almost impossible for us to verify whether the asset did indeed exist, and they struggled to construct the asset register presenting the names of their assets. So that is why we have raised that they need to do the basic controls, including the asset count, as well as doing this process that you do after doing the count. When you find that the numbers that you have on your system do not correspond with the numbers that you counted on the ground, that significant variance, it needs an investigation. That work was not done to see as to what causes the numbers to be so different from our expectation. So that is one of those key areas that needs to be done, and that must be done. Are there specific recommendations that we have raised? We have already raised a number of recommendations. We have also met with the minister in terms of this to say what can be done. In this case, our position has to change a little bit, because now we are looking into how can they retrieve the data that has been lost. We have suggested a number of actions that they can do, including using, because largely GPW has got a government institution as their suppliers, meaning we have recommended that they go to the government institution and request those invoices that they have submitted to them, or the data that they had given them, so that they can be able to use to construct the new data that will assist them to prepare a reliable financial statement. I think that will be mainly the areas that one has to cover in terms of this. And in terms of the action plan, I think I have highlighted just to say, look, I think they were faced with two choices as to whether to deal with the fire or not, or whether to deal with the system crash part. Are they recovering from the system crash? I can tell you that they are now doing backups, but what we are not yet sure of is whether the cause, the reason that makes them to have the system crash has been remedied, meaning they have been able to identify the reason that makes them to continue to lose data. Even though now they are backupping data and using those data tapes and so on, we are not sure whether there may not be new system crash that would also make them to try and retrieve it using these backups that they are doing now, which is the area that we sharply have to look into as we conclude evaluating the report that was given to us. Thank you. I think I wanted to stop there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other response? AG office.
Yes, Chairman Orendami. Then Rtivile.
Thank you, Pumanani. Greetings, Honorable Chair and honorable members of the committee. The first question that I'm going to take is with regard to the audit of the foreign missions. Chair, you will recall that DHA operates in more than 100 missions. So what we normally do is that we select a sample of the missions to be audited. And due to the COVID in the past 2 years, we were unable to physically visit these foreign missions. However, we were able to audit these missions from South Africa. And then from that audit of the foreign missions, we did not identify any material issues. The second question is on the observations that we made while we were auditing here in South Africa. In the current year, We visited the local offices, we visited the ports of entries, and we also visited the Lindela holding facility. From the Lindela holding facility and the ports of entries, we did not identify any issues of concern. However, when we visited the local offices, that's where we identified that the issue relating to the long queues, the system downtime, that also affected the service delivery and also resulting in some of the people having to go back home without getting any services. Another issue that we have identified at the local offices is that there are some buildings that DHA is operating on that are of poor quality. One building that I recall is the Chatsworth office. The building was of poor quality. It was raining and the people were getting rained on inside the building. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Honorable Chair, just to check.
Thank you, Honorable Tabani. We'll take the question on the claims against the department. The figure as disclosed per the financial statements is 2.3 billion, which is similar to what was disclosed in the prior year. The majority of these claims, they relate to immigration services. So, however, when the year started, there was an appeal which was dismissed in favor of the department. The value of that was about 630 million. However, after that, the department then received a summons from an applicant who was applying for a study permit. The applicant is suing the department about 500 million for failing to issue a permit timelessly. Yes, so the figure as disclosed is 2.3 billion, which is similar to what was disclosed in the prior year. Thank you.
Yes,
good morning, everyone. Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Thank you for the opportunity. In terms of IT, with the weaknesses that we have seen in the past, what we can say is there has been issues that have been raised since 1819 around IT. One of those, you know, being technical expertise around cybersecurity, and it's very key for both DHA and TPW, because what we're seeing a weak ICT security posture at the at both auditees, and it's something that we really need to look at. The other issue is we're seeing a lot of there is legacy, you know, systems, but what we're seeing that can be done and that has been raised is the infrastructure that is outdated, the operating systems that are being outdated. And what we can say is that both the department and GPW, they need to create a roadmap in terms of resolving the issues that have been raised since 1819, being infrastructure being one of them. And they need to look at the quick wins of what can be resolved. I mean, looking at this, resolving the legacy systems will be harder to resolve in short term than ensuring that, you know, the operating systems that are outdated, that are insecure, are replaced as soon as possible. The other thing that we have raised in the past, it's mainly around the strategy, and strategy drives the projects that you enter into as a department. And it's something that has been lacking previously, including the enterprise architecture in terms of what do you have, how is your infrastructure? Do I understand what is in my environment? So those things have been raised. But what we're seeing is there hasn't been leadership that will be able to resolve the issues that have been raised in the prior years. But then now we've seen that there has been CIO or leadership that has been appointed to ensure that these are really resolved. So all these issues have been raised 18-19, and they need to, you know, implement, create an action plan in ensuring that these have been raised, have been resolved. And I think historically there hasn't been consequence management, I would say, but now we've seen the auditees are starting to take action against employees that are not delivering, taking action to not resolving the action plans. It's something that they should continue in doing and ensuring their proper oversight is on IT. Thank you, Fumlani.
Thank you.
Those are our responses. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, colleagues. Thanks very much for issues that you have managed to respond. And thanks, honorable members, for engaging the Auditor General. We'll focus on the issues that you have raised. We'll interact with them, with the minister and the team. And some of the issues, I hope that the IEC will take note and respond to that once they conclude with their, or in the remark of their presentation. Thanks very much, AG. I'm sure that in our next session, when we're going to engage with the minister and govern printing works, you will be in attendance so that we're able to tap on some of the issues that you have raised. And you'll also be given opportunity to respond or comment on some of the issues that this institution may not have captured well in terms of the responses. Thanks very much. We're now going to invite your parting shot, Mr. Rabando.
No, we just want to appreciate the committee for this opportunity. And I think for me, if maybe I may be excused, Honorable Chair, I've got an engagement that I need to get to, but my colleagues will remain behind to also monitor the other engagements. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Deputy Commissioner?
Thank you, Chairperson. There is one question that I'm sure when the CEO and the CFO make the presentation around consequence management, I'm sure that they'll deal with that arises from the AG's report. But if, with your permission, if I could hand over to the CEO, he and the CFO will then take us through the presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, CEO.
Thank you very much, Chairperson of the committee, and greetings to members of the portfolio committee. Chair, let me get the this is the a summary or rather an outline of the presentation, which comes in two parts. The first part relates to an overview that I'll do. And the second aspect of the report will be delivered by the CFO, and it will get into the audit outcome, the statement of financial position and statement of financial performance and compliance with laws and regulations. This our honor to present this annual report, which covers activities undertaken by the Commission in the last financial year. This report encompasses the delivery of the sixth democratic municipal election and the election project in 2021 was possibly our biggest challenge yet as an institution, given that we had to deliver a free, fair, credible election during an uncertain period occasioned by the coronavirus pandemic, and following an important constitutional court ruling on our attempt to postponed at the election. The election was delivered in spite of a compressed 42-day election timetable and the introduction of new technology by way of the voter management device. So given this, the context of this challenge is the achievement of a clean audit for the second consecutive year is quite a remarkable feat. Okay. So it speaks the achievements of this clean audit speaks volumes about the dedication shown by Commission in their oversight responsibility, management, staff at all levels of the organization, staff at the voting stations, staff in our municipal offices, staff in our provincial offices, in our warehouses, and so on. So we really want to pay tribute to all involved from the Commission right away to the presiding officer and a queue worker in a voting station. But this achievement relates not only to the Commission's electoral mandate, but also to a firm commitment to financial probity in the organization, a realization that the resources that are placed at our disposal are for us to use to achieve the consolidation of electoral democracy and not to abuse them. So these are funds that the South African public places in our hands for purposes of realizing the constitutional lives of the country. Now, the way of summary for the year, Chair, we delivered a free and fair election in very difficult circumstances in the financial year under review, and we are reporting a clean audit for a second year on a trot. Now, by way of numbers, we had retabled 13 performance targets, and we were chasing 25, or rather we had at the end of the financial year, 25.8 million people still on the voters roll, of whom 91% we have an address for. and in terms of the gender split of the voters' role as at the financial year. And 55% are women and 45% are men. That trend has been prevalent for a very extensive period of time. In terms of the our staff, as at the end of the financial year, we had 909 permanent officials whose average age is 46, and we're reporting a staff turnover of 3.4%. We also had 133 by-elections held under those COVID conditions, and all those 133 municipal by-elections were declared free and fair. Now, in terms of our performance, we've realized 77% of the targets, and the voting district count as at the close of the financial year stood at 22,924, which means, because in each voting station, voting district, you have one voting station, that we had 22,924 voting stations on record. Our revenue for the year was 2.3 billion. Yet our operating expenses amounted to 2.6 billion. The CFO will get into the difference between the revenue and the operating expenses. But there's no overspend. I think it's important to realize that upfront. Now, if we get to the gist of the performance strategic outcome oriented goals, in program one, we had four targets, three of which have been achieved, and one not achieved, giving us an overall performance achievement of 75. In program two, we limited the targets to two, and none of which were achieved. And we will get into that within in the not too distant future from here. And program three, strengthening electoral democracy, we have five targets, all of which have been realized, the same as in program four, where we're dealing with issues of enhancement of transparency in election and party funding. Both of those targets were achieved. This gives us an overall performance achievement of 77%. 13 targets, 10 realized, 3 not achieved. So in a nutshell, that's our high level performance outcome. Now, if we look at each program in a little bit more detail, I won't be reading the purpose of the program. I think this is known to members of the portfolio committee. So starting on our right-hand side with the ICT environment, 98.3% of 2,214 hours of network and system availability was achieved. So, which means the target was achieved. And this is a very important target because it speaks to issues of business continuity, because each time the systems are not available, you are not able to work, you are not able to offer service to people, and so on. So it is very strategic because we are an IT-driven institution. So it's important that our system and network availability rating is as high as it is. So we are happy that we've been able to maintain a high level of performance in terms of our network and application and systems availability. In terms of our staff, we report a 81.4% of staff that were appointed at the time the financial year concluded, and that target was not achieved. The next one is issues of risk management, anticipating the risks in the environment and putting in place mitigation measures to ameliorate the possibilities of that risk happening, as well as putting in place measures to reduce the impact should that those risks eventuate. So all our strategic risk assessments were performed in line with the target that was set, and that the target was therefore achieved. Fourthly, the a clean audit that has been issued by the Office of the Auditor General. Now, there are a few things that I think are important in the realization of a clean audit. Firstly, it speaks to the quality of oversight processes in the organization. Because if your oversight processes are weak or not functioning optimally, the likelihood of the realization of a clean audit is impaired. Secondly, this outcome speaks also to the governance, the operation of the governance architecture of the institution, the role of the audit committee, the role of management within a combined assurance framework. But it also speaks to issues of financial probity and the culture that supports probity and so on. So we are quite happy with this outcome. But an outcome such as this, it's important that you keep the momentum going so that you don't regress in the next financial year. So it's one of the key strategic responsibilities of the Commission, of the Accounting Officer, of senior management and everybody to ensure that we don't regress from this achievement, but that we are able to build the momentum and realize this going forward. So that's one of the key strategic challenges of the institution going forward, that we do not regress from the achievement of where we are. And therefore that calls for everybody not demobilizing from the responsibilities that they need to perform: oversight, management responsibility, audit committee, playing a vigilant role over audit processes, risk management processes as well, as well as the policies that underpin the culture of the organization. So it's quite strategic and important. The second program is electoral operations, and here is really the gist and the core business, as it were, of the institution. There are two targets here, both of which have not been achieved. But let's look at them. The first is the management of free and fair elections. And the target here was no election should be set aside. And that, unfortunately, was not the case. The Electoral Court set aside a single ward in Ward 33 of Enoch Nkijima Municipality in the Eastern Cape. And the reason the Electoral Court set aside the by-election was because of the environmental circumstances surrounding the election, but not the mechanics of an election themselves. So the issue was not an impaired or compromised manner in which the election was delivered. The court took no issue with it, but the Electoral Court took issue with the happenings outside of the voting stations in the ward, where community members were protesting, burning tires and so on. Now, you'll immediately realize that the climate, the creation of a climate conducive to a free and fair election is not the sole responsibility of the Commission. We share that responsibility with political parties. We share that responsibility with the security services and so on. And the court felt that in this specific ward, the climate was not conducive and set aside that single ward. Our council was of the view that there were reasonable prospects of success on appeal. We, however, opted not to appeal in order to contribute to the stability of governance in the Enoch Nkijima municipality. Sometimes pursuing the legal course undermines political stability, which is so much needed for the delivery of municipal services. So we then reran that by-election. Going forward, we will have, because this is just a single word, we've got to resharpen our definition of the target to distinguish a single ward vis-a-vis a total council, as an example, because at the level of impact, if you have a single ward set aside, it's not the same as having the whole election outcome of a municipal council set aside. So we've refined that to take account of those distinguished scenarios. Secondly, the target that we did not realize was the size of the voters' roll. We did not achieve that because at the end of the financial year, we are at 25.8 million people on the roll. But the biggest contributor, or perhaps let's put it this way, we realized a net gain during registration weekends. The biggest contributor to the increase in the size of the voters' roll remain the registration weekends. Now, you'll recall that ahead of the 2021 elections, we could only muster a single registration weekend instead of the traditional two. And hence, we came short of the target that had been set. it was really a matter outside of our control. There were extraneous factors related to COVID and the restrictions that were placed to curb the impact of the pandemic on people. Now, in program three, we deal with our outreach program, and here we deal with our communications, our civic and democracy education. We deal with our research, our publications, as well as liaison with stakeholders. So all five targets in this area were achieved. Let's start then on the right hand, well, on the left hand side. We had set 10 leadership thought leadership. These are seminars where we present, where we invite professionals, academics, and so on to present thoughts about the nature and status of our electoral democracy. So throughout the country, we are able to achieve those 10 thought leadership interactions. In terms of stakeholder meetings, 55 were held. This is engagements with business, labor, traditional leadership, academic institutions, all myriad of stakeholders would have been met as part of the preparations for the elections. And in total, 55 meetings were held. Our research initiatives ahead of an election, we do research about what are the attitudes of people in relation to the forthcoming election. Are they intending to participate? Are they intending to register? Are there obstacles to them registering? And if there are, what are those obstacles? And that research is then used to prepare for our communication and voter education campaigns. So the type of communication that you see on here, see and hear on radio, is born out of the research that is undertaken 6 months or so earlier. So our campaigns are not just sitting on the air; they are grounded and have their foundation in the research about voter participation. The second type of research we do is actually on election day, where a representative sample of voting stations, we have voters being surveyed about, did they feel secure? Did they think that the procedures were fair? Do they think that they are vote is what's secret, the attitude and the service given by voting officials and so on. And this research is undertaken on our behalf by the Human Research Council. Now, our educational events, and these are your civic and democracy education that include, that moves from broadly civic education into balloting education towards the election. We've achieved and exceeded that. And then our multimedia communication, that's where we deal with your radio, TV campaigns and related things. And then lastly, in terms of this part of the report, Chair, is the party funding as well as political liaison. They've been grouped together as one program. And we have, as per law, made 4 disbursements to represented political parties, and that target was realized. The 4 disbursements are in relation to the represented political parties fund and the Multi-Party Democracy Fund if there are sufficient resources to distribute. So that happens on a quarterly basis. The 19 license sections held with stakeholders and potential contributors to Multi-Party Democracy Fund. Of course, we also engaged with stakeholders because we are actively seeking to resource through contributions to the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, where corporate, individual citizens, families, and so on can make contributions to the fund, and that fund is then used to distribute according to a set formula in the law to represented political parties. That is the performance report, and thank you very much for the audience. And I think, I will not be talking out of 10 when I say the guidance of the portfolio committee as well, the advice that we get often when we come before yourselves also has helped to get us to where we are as an institution, and we wish to thank you. And through you, Chair, if you allow us to allow the, if you give us an opportunity to get the Chief Financial Officer to give the financial report.
No, thank you, CFO. Ms. Mbata?
Thank you, Chair, and morning, Chair, and honourable members, as well as commissioners and colleagues. Chair, if I can just take you through the presentation, I will cover the AGSA audit. I'll give you highlights on the financial position as well as the financial performance. As well, I'll also then touch on the compliance with laws and regulation, and how far we are in terms of dealing with non-compliance issue. If I can move on to the next slide. I think, Chair, it's very key to actually bring to attention that there were no material findings that were identified by the AGSA during this audit. I think what's really key to us having achieved this is taking the AG's guidance, taking the findings and the recommendations very seriously, and really implementing what it is that they've recommended to us. If I can move to the next slide. I think it's also important to highlight the extent of testing that was also performed by our auditors. The AG has audited 3.5 billion of awards that were selected for testing. I think it's also very important to emphasize that the VMD procurement also formed part of that testing. And from the testing performed by the AG, they identified 0% of irregular expenditure. If we can move to the next slide. Chair, if we can move to the slide of the statement of financial position, the highlights. Chair, I think it's important to just highlight what we have done in terms of our financial position. We have capitalized the VMD in the current year, which amounted to 545 million that has come into our books. And strengthen our balance sheet. We've also got an increase. This is really emanating from our related party transactions, as well as prepayments that are coming from contracts relating to software. In our non-current liabilities, these are the normal operating leases, and we've also accounted for the lump sum position provisions. For our current liabilities, we also, these are normal trade payables, and because it's an election year, there is a high spike in the numbers. The net asset, really, Chair, this really reflects that it's an impact which shows the net effect between your current liabilities as well as your total liabilities versus your total assets. Not really need to emphasize on that one. If we can move on to the next slide, I think, Chair, this is where you normally see the impact of an election period. And I think it's very important that you can't really draw a relation between a current year and a prior year when you look at the nature of the work that we do as the IEC. If I can start with number one, which is a revenue from non-exchange transactions, that has increased by 7%. Important to emphasize this is an allocation. The CEO, in his starting point, made a comment that I will elaborate why would there be a difference between the expenditure and the income that we are getting. I think it's important to understand that we are reporting on GRAP. So when you report in GRAP, you're not just looking at the cash implementation impact of transaction, but you're also looking at the accrual elements. And that's the key difference. If we also then look at the revenue from exchange transactions, this is revenue that is actually being generated from the sponsorships that we had from the different rocks, as well as the investments that return on investment. This is coming from a positive balance that is sitting in the bank. Our goods and services have increased by 374%. As I've indicated, it is an election year. Our expenditure does spike like crazy. Our employee cost, the same can be said, with a 27% increase. Our audit fee is sitting at about 10 million for the current year. If you move to the next slide. Our key drivers in terms of expenditure, you'll see that our conference as well as our workshop cost increase, of printing and stationery, consumable, subsistence and travel, professional fees, communications, as well as connectivities, and then advertising cost. And those are really informed by the activities that we've had in the current financial reporting period. If we can move to compliance matters. Chair, this is just a global view of the irregular expenditure to date as we have as an institution. I think the one thing that we've taken as an institution is not to wait on the AG to identify deficiencies, but we are very proactive where we see an issue, a potential risk, and we then follow due process in accounting for it, looking at the framework and as well as engaging with National Treasury in instances of non-compliance. If I can start with the first block, this relates to irregular expenditure, which was incurred to the magnitude of 16 million. This resulted as a result of a deviation which was not supported by National Treasury. We did find ourselves in an election period with a tight timetable running with a need to get more ballot paper in addition to the ballot paper that had been procured. We did approach National Treasury, they did decline, but to date, that irregular expenditure has been condoned by National Treasury. We did account for it after the failure for National Treasury not approving the deviation. And the basis on which National Treasury had approved the condonement was on the following. Consequence management was implemented. The investigation and determination was done and concluded. There was no loss from this transaction, most importantly. And we also then took into consideration that anything going forward in terms of procurement of ballot paper, we've actually now started to see what must we do in terms of to ensure that we don't find ourselves in a shortage again in the future years and the future elections. So that is underway from an operational side. If we go to the next category, these are leases and municipalities. We've only managed to condone about 2.2 million. These are really emanating from administrative issues, political instabilities that are coming from municipalities. They are preferred location in terms of our operation. A significant portion relates to non-compliance coming from the prior years. But the condonement process is still underway. There's been quite a bit of engagement with National Treasury to assist us with a deviation with that portfolio. If I move on to our internal audit panel, this is an issue identified by management again. The condonement is also underway. We should be able to submit to National Treasury before the end of the year. This really, the non-compliance relates to a secondary procurement process, which is non-compliant. It emanates also the majorities coming from the prior years. And this issue was identified by management, and we then looked at the framework and applied and followed due process. The other matters really is a consolidation between issues that are picked up by the AG as well as management. We've only condoned 1.5 million, and it's really the issues are emanating from non-compliance with National Treasury's regulations. It's a mixture of prior year non-compliance issues. And yeah, and I guess the reason why we haven't fully condoned the items is because consequence management is not an overnight issue. It's something that takes a process, but it's something that we are working on, and it's work in progress. If we can move to the last slide. The last slide covers fruitless and wasteful expenditure. A lot of the fruitless is really coming from the prior years. The value of the refreshers in our books is 1.7 million. Of this, 98% relates to a fraud that happened in the prior years of 2008 and 2017. This matter has been referred to SAPS. The insignificant portion of that amount really relates to interest that was paid for late payments, interest incurred for late payments. Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks.
That's the report. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, CFO. Thanks very much, CEO. I will invite members to comment on that. Honorable Molekwa, Honorable Tito, Honorable Rose. These are the members who are here. Honorable Kanyile just got the emergency at school to interface with the matter that has been called for of a child. In that order, Honorable Molekwa.
Thank you very much.
Did you also, sorry, Chair. Did you recognize me as well?
Oh, yes. Honorable Mohale.
Thank you.
Thank you for that intervention. Honorable Molekwa.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me start by appreciating the presentation on the performance report by the IEC. And also like to congratulate the IEC on receiving the clean audit and the audit outcome. We hope that this trend will continue for future performance report that will be received in the next financial year. Continue making us proud in achieving those clean audit. Chairperson, I also like to encourage the IEC to start as early as possible in preparing for the 2024 national general election and make sure that it mobilizes as many people as possible, especially the young people who are eligible to vote in order to achieve the target, because in the presentation, the target was not achieved due to the challenges that we have faced on the COVID-19. So I think if the IEC can start preparing now, at least they will have more time to prepare for the mobilization on the voter registration. And on educational events, I think also the IEC should put more effort and resources for this purpose. Educational programs are very important, especially for voter registration and voter education. So if more resources and effort can be put in place and make sure that we register more people and more people are aware and have the knowledge on how to vote, especially with the challenging bill that we are busy with. So I think it will be more of assistance. On fruitless and expenditure, we appreciate the fact that it was reported and the law enforcement agency will wait for the outcome on the report on this matter. Mr. Chairperson, we'd like to note and welcome the report as presented. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your contribution. Honorable Tito.
Thanks, Chair. I would also like to appreciate the report that was given by the IEC. Chair, my question is, how are the 165 million, please call me, administered, and what are the measures used to ensure there is a relationship between the information received and the education done on this on the please call me? And Chair, how much is it estimated that the 66 by-elections held during the year under review have cost us in the IEC? And then, and also Chair, on the GPWP, how much of the printing of ballot papers is done by the government printing works? Could the government printing works do all the ballots if required to do so? Or will the IEC need help maybe from somewhere, but now in terms of the profit, we need the government printing works to do everything so that it must receive the profit, because of the profit at the end of the day is going to gain us as the government. And then, Chair, what are some of the logistical and financial implications of significant increases in political parties and their candidates? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Tito. Honorable Ross.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the IEC for the presentation. Chair, credit where it is due, and congratulations to the IEC on another clean audit and a reduction in the irregular expenditure. I just have two brief questions. You know, we obviously had a concern about the VMDs during this period, and even though we were delighted they were procured, so I'd just like to get an understanding of whether all those issues have now been addressed, the training issues, the technical issues, and whether we're now moving forward on a smooth trajectory in that regard. And then just what is the status of appointing the chairperson of the Electoral Commission after the reinstatement or the reappointment of Mr. Mashinini as a commissioner? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Ross. Honourable Mohale.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We congratulate the IEC for a clean audit report. I have a couple of questions that I just want to pose to the Commissioner. Firstly, Chairperson, on Programme 2, which they presented here, which speaks about maintaining voters' role. I just want to find out, Chairperson, what measures is the IEC putting in place to ensure that the 17 million eligible adults who are supposed to be registered to vote but are not currently on the voters' roll, what measures is the IEC putting in place to ensure that we are able to reach out to those 17 million eligible voters so that these things of the low voter tellouts, we try also to vet them going forward, Chairman, because the more people we have on our voters' roll, I think it also improves the likelihood that we'll have more people turning up to vote in the upcoming election. So I just want to find out what is the Electoral Commission doing to ensure that we increase the voters' roll. And then secondly, Chair, see, they speak about three research initiatives as part of Program 3 highlights. They speak of three research initiatives which were achieved and exceeded. I don't know, are they referring to their own internal research that they are conducting in terms of whatever topics that they are interested in, or maybe if they can provide clarity? Because what I want to highlight, Chair, is that in the aftermath of the Cambridge Analytica scandal that we witnessed in other countries, we know that they also had operations here in South Africa, or they were intending to operate here in South Africa. So what measures does the IEC have to ensure that our electoral system is protected, is safeguarded from these nefarious big tech companies who are able to take advantage of our people through their massive psychological propaganda campaigns? What measures does the IEC have in place to deal with that? Because I believe that we do have companies, big tech companies who are working with certain political parties, are trying to really do the very same practices that Cambridge Analytica was accused of here in South Africa. So I just want to know what is it that the IEC is doing to combat, to deal with some of those things, because those things can really affect the integrity of our electoral system if they are allowed to happen. And perhaps my last question, Chair, on by-elections. On the issue of by-elections, we have noticed that when we go to some of these by-elections, Chairman, you'll find that there are people who will come there complaining that they've been removed from the voters' roll without notice. They have just been removed from the voters' roll. They go to the voting station and all of a sudden their names do not appear on the voters' roll. So I just want to know, because we were told that the IEC, before they can remove anyone from the voters' roll, they go around and inform people to say that, no, according to the information we have and the address you provided, you are not a resident of this particular ward, therefore we have to remove you from the voters' roll. But we have several cases that we have encountered personally, Chairperson, where people have been removed from the voters' roll without being notified. Without being notified, they go to the voting station. When they get there, their names are not there. So if I can get the responses on those three questions. Thank you very much, Chair.
No, thanks very much, honorable members, for your contributions and also appreciation of the good work the IEC demonstrated over the years and their audit outcome. I think we must join in congratulating the team, but also the plans to sustain the outcomes. Just on the last question or comment of Honorable Mogale, Commissioner, I think just to re-emphasize, perhaps, I know that when you were dealing with your reporting on the, you were giving the committee the report on the 2021 local government elections, you have tapped into the plans on how we are going to mitigate the weaknesses identified, as the Honorable Mogale raises, that there were many citizens, eligible voters, who were turned in their VDs. You have been voting in the VD for a longer time, but when you arrive at the VD, you are then been turned to another. You are told you are going to register 50 cases or so from where you are residing. Perhaps in terms of the how progress to that effect, so that to check whether the system that you are putting in place, have you tested it to correct those anomalies that were identified, and I think which you, the IEC, have acknowledged to that space. We are raising this now that we were approaching closer to 2024 provincial and national elections, and also with the new amendment that will be getting into. What are the plans and also the education programs or outreach that will assist us to mobilize the young in particular to participate in these elections. Those are the issues that are coming from the members. We're going to now give the Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Laffey, then you will delegate to the CEO, or we can start with the CEO and end with the commissioners. Maybe I may not use that discretion. CEO.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to be working with my colleagues in the outreach that Mosri, Lindate Shiburu, as well as the CFO, respond to the questions of the committee. Just to deal with the issue of the registration of young people, as well as the 17 million people who that the Mogale says are not registered. The Commission obviously wants to maximize opportunities for South Africans to enlist on the roll. And for that purpose, there are a number of modalities that are employed to register South Africans. And I'll deal with them one in ten. The mainstay modality for registration remains the registration weekends. And as I indicated in the presentation, the registration weekends give us the greatest registration yield of any modality. Because, and there are reasons for that. Because voting stations are within a walking distance of people in communities. And a registration weekend has an equalizing potential in that everybody has to walk to a voting station. You don't necessarily need a car to be able to get to your station and so on, because voting stations are really within close proximity to where people live. So ahead of 2024, the Commission is contemplating two registration weekends to maximize the registration of those that are not registered, those that who have changed addresses, and also to give people an opportunity to come and confirm the correctness of their registration details, in part to deal with the issue that that Mogale, you're referring to regarding by-elections, and which has been underscored by the chairperson of the committee. But although the registration weekends are your mainstay modality, they are not the sole modality for registration. Last year, in July, we introduced the online registration portal, so that at least that segment of South Africans who have access to the digital economy can take advantage of that facility and register at their leisure 24/7. Of course, that registration modality is underpinned by security measures, because you don't want to open a flood and compromise the credibility of the voter's role. But that we have discussed and clarified with political parties in the National Party Liaison Committee. That modality, just to give an example, ahead of the election, it gave us over 500,000 new registrations, a substantial majority of whom were young persons. Ahead of 2024, there's a need to give life to that registration portal, and we will be running a campaign just on that thing, on that portal, in social media especially, where young people ordinarily converse about the country, its politics, and so on. So that is in the offing. Thirdly, there is ongoing registration, not giving us as much yield as we hope it would, but it's available nonetheless, that those who wish to register, you can go to any of the offices of the IEC, over 250 of them throughout the country. And lastly, precisely because of what Honorable Moletwa says about young people, in this current financial year, we have been visiting institutions of higher learning where we've done civic and democracy education programs together with the universities or technicons or TVET colleges. And we also ran registration activities at those institutions of higher learning, precisely to ensure that we get the young people to be on the voters' roll. A similar program unfolded during April within the formal schooling system, what we refer to as the school's democracy week that coincides with April 27, where not only did we go do civic and democracy education, but we accompanied that with a registration opportunity linking with Home Affairs so that when they deliver IDs in schools, we are there, and that's that is ongoing. The So all those are the modalities that are currently in the offing, but they'll be escalated as we get into, we intensify preparations for 2024. But as regards young people, we're not even waiting for the campaign to start. We're working in campuses already to try to bolster the number of young people who are registered. Now, there's one issue that Honorable Tito raises about the significant increases that are anticipated relative to the introduction of independent candidates. As we stand here today, we don't know how many independent candidates are going to be participating in the elections in 2024. We can only know that on the close of nomination as to how many have met the requirements for participation in the election. And so on. But there are certain realities that the Commission is working on. And here are the facts. From 1994, we've been using a single column ballot. With a listing of parties according to the draw for the position on the ballot that we do, and then following alphabetically from the party that wins the draw. So that has been our experience. But the single column ballot can only go to a maximum of 600 millimeters because you can only accommodate so many parties. I think we had 48 the last time. And to accommodate more on a single column ballot is going to prove to be a challenge. So what this means is that for the first time in 2024, we may have to introduce there may be a departure from the single column ballot. It may be double column, it may be A4 size, A3 size ballots, and so on. The point of the matter is that in order to accommodate the anticipated number of independents, it will have a ballot implication. And the commission will decide that in time as to how they configure the ballot to accommodate. But it will have a significant ballot configuration. So that's one. Two, anything beyond 600 millimeters, the number of printing presses capable of accommodating, the number of printing presses capable of printing a 600 millimeter length ballot is fewer. So which means your capacity to print within that defined time period is limited. So that's another logistical challenge that we are contemplating. And the fewer the capacity, it means the longer it takes you to print the ballot, pack it per voting station, ensure that it's delivered under secure circumstances, and maintain security until it's used at the voting stations. Now, that the rules, the issue about the VMDs, you're right. We had limited training opportunities ahead of the registration weekend last year. And we also had limited opportunities for running effective dry runs to stress test the VMDs. Those issues, the infrastructure part of it, are being addressed to ensure that we have sufficient infrastructure to accommodate the traffic that is anticipated on the network. As well as refining our business applications, because part of the problem was that our business applications were reading, for instance, in the maps, we were reading too many layers of maps. So we needed to simplify the layers that we have on our mapping functionality. So all those things are done and so on. We will be having more stress testing opportunities ahead of the registration weekends, so that the refinements, additional refinements that may be required, are done well ahead of time. Chair, with your permission, I'll ask that Shiburu to deal with the issues related to the electoral system, the protection thereof against initiatives such as the Cambridge Analytica, and then to deal with the issue of the by-elections and people not finding their names on the voter's roll. And then that mostly to deal with the research question and the as well as the SMS issue that Metito raised. Dr. Shuburu can also deal with the government printing works and the printing capacity for ballot papers. And then the CFO can sweep with the cost of the by-elections. And the issue relating to the status of the appointing of the chair, I'll leave that to members of the commission. Thank you, and that Chabani Kelebo.
Thank you, CFO. Sorry, CEO, Mawabulo. Mr. Shiburi.
Thanks, Chair. The issues raised by Honorable Mukhari around the Cambridge Analytica underscore the continued need for all of us, all role players, to continue to guard the democratic gains jealously. Because if you do not, you're going to find people who have resources at their disposal, who can unleash all sorts of things on society with the purpose of influencing outcomes of elections. In the classical case of Cambridge Analytica in the Pacific Rim, they were able to change governments by launching campaigns which were calculated to impact certain demographic differently. So it would encourage participation among certain racial groups and make sure that certain other demographics do not go out to participate. So this is something that not only the Electoral Commission can deal with by itself. On our part, we must make information available to voters so that there is a repository body of information to check information that voters receive, to check the veracity of information that they receive. But there is also a greater part on the part of contestants, including political parties, to make sure that their campaigns are informed, but they also give voters the tools to be able to deal and decipher campaigns that are intended to alter their voting behavior. In our case, it is possible that those attacks will be targeted at the young persons because they are the biggest demographic in terms of age groups, but they are also the majority of consumers of online content and new information. The issue related to the capacity of government printing works to print ballots. We had considered this in our past. We are not averse to this, but the reality is that, as the CEO had indicated, there is no single printer in the country who has the capacity to alone print the requisite number of ballot papers in the short window period that we have. The two key determinants are the following: the size and different permutation of ballot papers, as well as an immutable time period within which we needed to print. In local government election, you have no fewer than 4,700 different ballot and unique ballot types for each election. So to print those, to package those for per voting station and ensure that they are distributed within the 18 days available to us to print and distribute, it is not possible that a single company can do that. That includes a government printing works. To raise also an issue that the CFO had dealt with as it related to the 16 million irregular expenditure that we incurred in the printing of ballots. In 2021, we had 18 days to print ballot papers, and it was 4,700 combinations. We had appointed a panel of printers to do that, but because we were managing the printing very tightly, it became very clear to us that all the printers to whom we had allocated work would not be able to print the ballots in time for the elections. In that context, we had to go and look at other printers outside of that basket and award work to them as a way of risk mitigation to ensure that come special voting days, we had ballot papers. Given the contracted time period, we were able to print and finalize printing in certain areas a day or so just before we opened for special voting. So in short, we need as big a pool of printers to print within the time frame within the constrained time periods. And our preference is always that we must print package locally and not have a reason to rely on external printers from outside of the Republic to print ballot papers, as is the case in other jurisdictions. The last point, CEO, that I'll deal with relates to persons who claim or who find out at voting stations that they have been removed from segments of the voters' roll. Since the judgment in 2016 at the Concord, there is an obligation on the chief electoral officer that he must ensure that a voter who appears on the voter's roll with an address, there is a nexus between that voting district and the address that the voter has supplied. So while we can offer broad strokes in terms of responses, I would also appreciate if Honorable Mogale is also able to give us those specific things so that we don't speak in broad terms, but we can zoom in into the specific and ensure that we do not disenfranchise certain persons. Suffice just to say, there is a peremptory obligation on the CEO to change the registration status of a voter if the CEO is satisfied that the details of the voter have changed. If, for example, a person appears on the segment of the voter's roll with an address that is not found within that voting district, the CEO must change and amend the voter's roll to change the registration of that person. However, the procedure that we employ is that we still offer those persons a fair administrative process in that we allow them to make representation. While in some cases we are able to get through to those voters, in some instances we are unable to. For an example, a voter supplied a address that does not locate within the ward, or the address does not exist at all, or the address is fictitious. When we serve notices at that address, the voter will not receive that notice because they're not ordinarily resident at that address, and they will know for the first time when they come to a voting station to try to register that their details have been updated. And by updating doesn't mean that the person loses franchise rights. We do not remove you totally from the voter's roll. We default your registration to an address that we have for you on record, so that in all material times, a voter appears on a segment of the voter's roll where there is a nexus between the description of an address or a place of ordinary residence and the segment of the voter's roll where a voter must vote. The second category are persons who may have gone online to update their registration details, or who went online to register themselves for the first time or to update their details. And if they provide an address, our system reads from an address. It has a logic of an address. So it will use that address to default a voter to a voting district within which that address locates. Similarly, if a person comes to a voting station in Centurion and we register them in the context of a VMD, the logic has changed. In the past, when we used the ZipZips, if you presented yourself at a voting station and your address did not locate you within the boundary of that station, we either redirected you to a voting station, or if we registered you there, you would have been defaulted into that segment of the voter's roll. In the context of the VMD, and in trying to give effect to the court or to the constitutional court order, a voter can present themselves at any voting station. However, when we process their registration, that registration will not default to the station at which they presented themselves, but it will default to a voting district that is linked to the address that the voter provided when they applied for registration. The last point to be made on the, and the CEO dealt with this, on voter registration, is that the number of people registered as voters and the number of people who actually turn out to vote in an election are an important indicator of the health of the of electoral democracy. However, following a number of research over time that we've conducted, we know now that people do not register, not because it is administratively burdensome, but because increasingly the majority have lost trust in key political institutions. And because of that, they did not see a value in participating. We also know, however, that if the IEC runs voter registration campaigns, if political parties launch their manifestos and start running campaign, that has the impact of rekindling interest among people who were already growing despondent. In the context of those campaigns, they have an effect of reversing the psyche of people and getting them to come and participate. That was demonstrated clearly last year with disrupted campaigns in the turnout on voting day, and also the few number of people that were registered as voters in that campaign. CEO, I think I've dealt with all the issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mosre.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. I'm dealing with the three research projects. These relate to three broad areas of research. The first one, we did a study on the willingness to vote under the conditions and circumstances of the pandemic, COVID-19. And the second one was a study we did on voter participation. This study explores the reasons why South African citizens are willing to go out and vote and what motivates them to go and vote. And if they are not voting, what could be their reasoning and their views around that? And some of the assertions that Mr. Shiburu has just presented relate to the outcomes of this study. The related also finding that we get out of this study is those willing to register as voters, even if they do not participate on voting day, and those that are not registered and not willing to register as voters. And this is a continuous study. It has over 15 years of review. And we have very good findings over a period of time that can continuously be shared with the members of the honorable members of the portfolio committee. The third study focuses on election day, the level of satisfaction with the administrative processes at the voting station, and how they experienced the voting process, and if there are any views or recommendations for further improvement, we are able to deal with that. This is where we get to know that the whole voting process is accessible to voters and they can interact with that. So annually, we have our own research agenda and areas that we focus on. This year we have a focus also on party funding, which is a new area that we've not researched before. So in summary, Chair, the three research projects are initiated by ourselves as the Commission, and they help influence our election planning, our election programs. And indeed, the voter participation study influences our campaigns on young voters. And it also informs us about the appropriate platforms for particularly young voters, which are influential and where they get most of their messages. And it also deals with the kind of messages they want to hear. One matter that we may leave with the honorable members is that the voter turnout, as we deal with it on voting day, is different from the number that was indicated by the honorable member of 17 million unregistered voters. So during the voter registration campaign, our target is plus minus the 36 million that we had been given as an estimation of eligible population of South Africa to vote. And we continuously target to reach all of those people. They make various choices to participate or not, to be on the voter's roll. But what then becomes your key voter turnout statistic on voting day is your 26 million registered voters. How many of them do come out and vote on election day, and what motivates them to come out and vote, particularly in recent times and recent elections? Voters talk to us about understanding the voting process, the reasons why they should vote, but they are not interested. And that talks to also how the campaigns of the various political competitors have been and the impact they make on voters. But we continue to do our duty in terms of encouraging participation and supporting the participation of voters. That's in brief, Chair, what I needed to respond. Thank you.
Thank you, CFO, Ms. Mbati, if there's anything to...
Thank you, Chair. Chair, there was a question regarding the cost of by-elections. The period wasn't stipulated, so I'll just confirm for the last financial year, it's 8.2 million.
Okay, can I establish, before I invite the commissioners, if members, you want to follow up or there's any other matter?
I'll start. Yes, with, Chair.
Yeah, I'll start with Honorable Mokgale. Honorable Tito, do you have a follow-up?
I'm fine, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Ross, do you have a follow-up?
No, Chair, I'm fine.
Okay. Honorable Malekwa?
No follow-up, Chair, something.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Honorable Mokgale, you can proceed.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks for the responses from the commissioners and the CEO. Chair, I think particularly on the issue of the 10 million eligible voters who are not on the voters roll, I think the IEC should be more aggressive in terms of targeting those particular eligible voters. Because our voters roll has been sitting at around 26 million for, I think, from around 2016. Going towards 2024 election, which I think would be going to be a very important and a crucial election, I think as part of the preparation, the IEC should really be on an aggressive campaign to ensure that at least we increase the voters roll by at least 30 million in 2024. I think it's possible, Chair. I think with proper planning, enough resources, I think it's possible so that we are able to get as many people to form part of the electoral process. So I think maybe that's something that the IEC should look into. And I think this thing of only running two voter registration weekends leading up to the election, I think we should rather have more than two, not just two and then that's it. I think let's have more than two and then see what is the impact in terms of increasing the number of participants. Thank you very much, Chair.
Well, thank you, Honorable Mokgale, for your comments. I'm now going to invite Deputy Commissioner, and you will then invite other commissioners and respond to the comments on the issues, including the follow-up that has been raised by Honorable Mokgale. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Laff.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to ask that Dr. Masuku will pick up on questions of working with youth as well as covering other matters pertaining to things like research that she is very knowledgeable about. I just wanted to respond to the question by Honourable Ruth regarding the issue of designation. Although we're a full commission, we're at full strength of the five commissioners at the moment, the issue of designation is not within our hands. It is something that is at the decision of the president, and we have not heard. So I don't know anything further that we can say in that regard. Insofar as the issue that was raised by Honourable Mokgale is concerned, concerning the question of Cambridge Analytica, I just wanted to add to what the Deputy CEO had already raised in terms of the vigilance that is required, in particular by political parties and contestants in an election, but also not just the vigilance, but also I think internal training. We do find that there are a lot of situations where very experienced and committed members of different political parties sometimes take on board issues that are received by them through social media and retweet, repost and so on. And I think that there are a number of ways in which this can be ameliorated through good training of people. And to that extent, the commission has also worked with the platforms who are willing to provide some support to political parties and contestants. So I think that that's something that certainly can be followed up. We're very alive to the worry, and so working together with all of you and colleagues in your different organizations is of great importance. But I wonder if I could hand over to Dr. Masuku, and then if there is anything to sweep, I'm sure that Commissioner Muyeke will deal with that. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks, Honourable Members.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair, and greetings to all Honourable Members. I think I've only got one further comment to make, and that has to do with the pool of citizens to which the Honourable Mokgale refers when he states that we've been sitting at a voter's roll with 26 million people for a very, very long time, and that is indeed true. I think what we have tried to do is to have two workshops, one internal, one external, just to show us why it is that if the issue is not that they are structural impediments, in other words, the processes that the Electoral Commission has put in place are not the reason why people choose not to register, then what else is going on? What the research is telling us is, I think, reason for all of us to be concerned. The reasons are that people are making a deliberate decision not to participate in electoral processes. And the research shows, the researchers have offered us two postulations. The first is that people are just saying that they don't see the value of participating in the electoral democracy, and there are declines in terms of people's belief in the political system. And I think that is the work that we have to focus on, not just as the Electoral Commission. The Electoral Commission, I think, commits itself to do everything possible to mobilize, to reach out to young people as we are and increase all of that. But I think this is a problem that will need all players, and especially the contestants. We need to have a view about what is causing the intransigence that we're picking up and what it is that we can do. I don't think it is something that we can fix merely by having more registration weekends, even though I suppose the more the better. I think there's something that is going on there that needs the attention of members, honorable members sitting over here. We need to get a handle on what is going on in the minds of South Africans, especially young South Africans, especially because in South Africa, you've got what is called a youth bulge. You've got a lot of young people. And if they're deliberately opting out of the electoral process, then there is a problem that I think we have to look at. Vice Chair, I'm going to stop there and just say that I hope that we create more opportunities to look further at this, but the answers and the solutions are not simple. They require much more than what we've done, what we've always done, but from both sides of where we sit, both as the Electoral Commission and the people that are represented by the honourable members. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, I say good afternoon to you. I have listened to the team. There is absolutely nothing to see. They have swept clean. Thank you very much.
No, thanks very much. Deputy Commissioner Love, your parting shot. Commissioner Mashinini?
Sorry, Chairperson, Commissioner Mashinini is no longer on the call. So I don't know if there's anything further from other colleagues that we have missed that you've observed. So we're in your hands, Chair.
Okay. Thanks very much, colleagues. We appreciate the presentation. Members of the committee have interacted with the report. There are areas where they were concerned, and I think we've managed to clarify them. And I think your report gives effect from the presentation you made just after the election earlier this year on the 2021 last year local government elections. I think we must, as Honorable Ross indicated, that we must really appreciate the good work of the commission, all the commissioners and the executive led by Mr. Mamabolo and your entire staff complement throughout the country. Where there are weaknesses as we move forward towards the local, provincial and national elections, we may be closer to work with the IEC. It is quite important that we must take responsibility as the political parties or members from various political parties to jointly work with the IEC in mobilizing and perhaps in contributing to the voter education, because those voters are voting for political parties or individual that will be participating in these spheres of legislative. So we'll take that note and utilize the spaces or resources to contribute to this voter education. Quite important that you have now interacting with the high institution in terms of the voter education. Well, I also want to appreciate your continuous clean governance and the financial outcomes as has been demonstrated by the Auditor General. We appreciate the good work the IEC. Mr. Matonsi, you will then allow us to brief us on the process that we're going to engage in the next committee meeting, and then we stand off this meeting. Mr. Matonsi?
Yes, Chairperson, I've made an application for the committee to meet tomorrow during lunchtime.
The reason is that why we're meeting during lunch is because other members, they might belong to other committees that they will be attending in the morning and also in the afternoon. So tomorrow we are going to receive the B-Bill, which the legal service of Parliament and the state law advisors, they are working closely with the department and the IEC on finalizing the B-Bill. So yeah, so tomorrow also we'll also try to ensure that no, we adopt the report and both bills. We have to go clause by clause, and then the committee votes, and then from there we adopt the bill and the report, and then it's just sent to the National Assembly Chairperson. That is for tomorrow, and then like I said earlier on, then next week we are going to be having the department and government printing works on their annual report. That's that, Chairperson, and also that we have made an application for this joint oversight on illegal mining, which is going to take place from Friday in the Northwest Province. We're still waiting for the approval by the House Chair. Chairperson, thanks.
Okay. No, thanks, colleagues. Those are the notes for tomorrow. The committee will convene at 1 to finalize the report and the B-Bill. Then we'll then await Mr. Matons, if the minister next week goes to another country, just for purpose of preparing my mind, we're not going to receive the government printing works report. I just wanted to ascertain my mind.
If the minister goes to, in terms of the letter that we received, Chairperson, the minister is coming back home on Friday.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, thanks very much. That will be our process for tomorrow and next week, and the joint sitting as Mr. Matonsi, as joint oversight over the weekend for illegal mining. Thanks very much, the team, Auditor General, for having stayed with us. And we request that also you join us in the next meeting where the minister will be in attendance. Thanks very much. The meeting stands adjourned.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thanks, Chair. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon.